From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, stories from the boxing ring. FX Tool started boxing in his late 40s and became a cut man, the corner man who stops the boxers bleeding so he can fight another round. Now at the age of 70, Tool has a collection of short stories about boxing. Also, the origins of American gun culture. We talk with historian Michael Belial. His new book, Arming America, argues that the image of the early Americans protecting themselves with guns is a myth. Few Americans own guns, even on the frontier, until the Civil War. And music critic Milo Miles weighs in on Napster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Yugoslav Election Commission says a runoff vote for president must be held because neither Slobodan Milosevic nor his opponent held a clear majority in last Sunday's election. The BBC's Nick Thorpe has more from Belgrade.
The Federal Election Commission's declaration that a second round will be necessary has been met with disbelief and anger by opposition leaders. Žarko Korać, leader of the Social Democratic Union, one of an alliance of 18 parties which backed Vojislav Koštunica, told the BBC that the opposition refused to accept the official result. Election results are not negotiable, he said, and accused the present government of attempting to play with the will of the people. According to the Democratic Opposition's own count of the votes carried out at polling stations, Mr. Koštunica received 1 million votes more than President Slobodan Milosevic, well over the 50% threshold and enough to give him outright victory. The opposition can now be expected to demand proof from the Federal Election Commission.
The BBC's Nick Thorpe. Attorney General Janet Reno told a Senate panel today that if former Los Alamos nuclear scientist Wen-Ho Lee had gone to trial, he would have been convicted on all counts of mishandling classified nuclear information. FBI Director Louis Freeh dismissed allegations that Lee was singled out because he's a Chinese-American at a time when China was accused of stealing U.S. nuclear secrets. The top Justice Department officials said prosecutors accepted a plea bargain to avoid revealing secret information in court. A biotechnology company says it will stop selling a variety of genetically engineered corn. The corn's only been approved for use in animal feed, but was found in some taco shells last week. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
Aventis Crop Science is suspending sales of Starlink corn until the FDA approves its use in food for humans as well as animals. The corn is genetically engineered to produce Cri9C, a naturally occurring insecticide. The FDA says eating Starlink corn has not been shown to pose any health risks, but some scientists are concerned it could trigger allergic reactions. About 25% of the corn grown in the U.S. is genetically modified. A half of 1% is Starlink. Last week, an anti-biotech environmental organization found Starlink corn in taco shells sold by Kraft. Kraft subsequently recalled the shells from supermarkets. On Monday, the Biotechnology Industry Organization wrote the FDA recommending that only grain products approved for both animals and humans be sold domestically. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 175 points, or 1.6%, to close at 10,632 in moderate trading of 1.1 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 51 points to close at 3689. This is NPR News from Washington. Talks in the Los Angeles transit strike have broken off. The union's chief negotiator said the Metropolitan Transportation Agency rejected a compromise offered by state mediators. The strike by bus and rail operators is in its 11th day, leaving nearly a half million commuters to find alternate transportation. Thousands of German truck drivers clogged Berlin's main traffic artery today to protest rising fuel costs. The truckers are demanding an end to the so-called ecology tax on gasoline. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Berlin.
Germany hasn't suffered from the massive fuel protests that have hit France and Great Britain. German law forbids unauthorized protests that inconvenience commuters and workers. So today's rally, while comparably restrained to others in Europe, was significant. Traffic in Berlin was backed up for hours today along a 10-mile stretch of the city's main thoroughfare. Commuters opted to use public transport. The truckers are demanding that Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder's left-center government eliminate or reduce high fuel taxes. Schroeder, like his counterpart in Great Britain, Tony Blair, has refused. Instead, Schroeder has offered drivers tax breaks. The truckers say that's not enough and blame high fuel prices for an increase in unemployment rates among German truck drivers. Guy Raz, NPR News, Berlin.
American consumers were slightly more optimistic about the economy in September, and the Conference Board said its index of consumer confidence rose by about a point this month, despite rising energy costs. The organization said consumers remain in an upbeat mood despite higher prices for gasoline and home heating oil. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. FX Tool learned to box when he was in his late 40s. It was too late to make it as a boxer, but he stayed in that world as a cut man. In between rounds, the cut man stops his boxer's bleeding so that he can get back in the ring. Now at the age of 70, Tool has a new collection of short stories called Rope Burns. The review in the LA Times described it as a book of chillingly authentic short stories about fighters and fighting, written from as far inside as you can get. Although Tool has a trunk full of novel stories and plays, this is his first published book. He didn't want his boxing friends to know that he was writing stories set in their world, so he used the pen name FX Tool. But the good reviews have blown his cover. His real name is Jerry Boyd. Let's start with a reading from the first story in Rope Burns, which is about a cut man.
I stop blood. I stop it between rounds for fighters so they can stay in the fight. Blood ruins some boys. It was that way with Sonny Liston, God rest his soul. Bad as he was, he'd see his own blood and fall apart. I'm not the one who decides when to stop the fight, and I don't stitch up cuts once the fight's over, and it's not my job to hospitalize a boy for brain damage. My job is to stop blood so the fighter can see enough to keep on fighting. I do that, maybe I save a boy's title. I do that one thing, and I'm worth every cent they pay me. I stop the blood and save the fight. The boy loves me more than he loves his daddy. But you can't always stop it. Fight guys know this. If the cut's too deep or wide, or maybe you've got a severed vein down in there, the blood keeps coming. Sometimes it takes two or three rounds to stop the blood, maybe more. The boy's heart is pumping so hard, or he cuts more. Once you get the coagulant in there, sometimes it takes another shot from the opponent right on the cut itself to drive the blood far enough from the area so the stuff you're using can start to work. What I'm saying is there are all kinds of combinations you come up against down in the different layers of meat. When a good cut man stays ahead of the combinations, he can stop most cuts, but not every one.
And that's FX Tool reading from his new collection of short stories, Rope Burns. Let's talk a little bit more about what you do as a cut man. What are some of the medicines that you have to stop bleeding?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's illegal, but most of the time you're using, and I say most of the time, I'm generalizing, but you use adrenaline 1-1000. It's a topical, and it's a vasoconstrictor, not the kind you inject. Then there's thrombin, which is a coagulant rather than a vasoconstrictor. There's stuff called Atovine. Much of this stuff is used during surgery.
What's your training like to do this? Do you study medicine at all, or do you just study with another cutter?
You study with other guys. You pick their brains. You have to remember that what you're working on is a restricted area, and the tissue's not very deep. Okay, it's not as if you're trying to work on someone who's suffering a stab wound in the liver. It's shallow tissue. Sometimes it looks like during the fight. Sometimes you think you're looking down into a volcano, but it's that's obviously not the case. So you're working on the face primarily, the forehead, the scalp maybe, and so you learn how to stop that blood. You don't learn how to deal with stab wounds.
Tell me more about what goes on in the corner during the period between rounds. If the fighter is tired and he's bleeding, who's paying attention to him? What's everybody doing? Who's competing for his time there?
Well, what you do is you get him breathing deeply from the diaphragm, number one. and you water him down. You put ice packs on him, and you get him breathing. Now, if he's cut, you've got to do all of that and get the blood stopped at the same time. But the fighter is completely focused on you, and he trusts you. He's put his life in your hands, which is one of the reasons I'm so careful about what I do with these kids. And so he's focused on you, and he's learned through the whole training process to listen to you. While the crowd is roaring, he will hear your voice above them all if you shout instructions up to him. But now he's cut, and now he's tired. You get him breathing. You cool him down. And you'll be surprised how someone in good condition, and I'm speaking cardiovascular now, will revive in just that time. Now, if he's terribly hurt, I've called fights off. But that's the last resort. You don't want to do that because, again, his future is in your hands. But you don't want to make a decision to make his future his past either.
As the cut man, it's your job to stop the blood when a boxer's bleeding, when your boxer's bleeding. And I'm wondering how the whole idea of bleeding has changed in the HIV era.
Well, you know, when the HIV really hit and AIDS was rampant and it first hit, got the publicity it did, 10 years or so ago, we were instructed to wear gloves, rubber gloves. The fighters at that time and since have had to take AIDS tests. So at that time it was a much bigger problem than it is today. Now I don't even think they hand out rubber gloves anymore because the AIDS test comes along and it's yesterday. You follow? And so they know whether or not these guys are infected. There was a heck of a heavyweight here not too long ago whose test proved positive for AIDS. And here was a big monster of a guy. The odds are he got it using steroids because he was a tall, thin kid at one time. And 2 years later, he's a monster heavyweight.
How would you get AIDS by using steroids?
The needle.
Oh, I see. Got it.
So these guys might be in the gym and say, here, you use the needle, I'll use the needle, you use the needle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People often are quite foolish in terms of what they do.
What are the worst injuries you've seen your fighters sustain?
Basically, the worst that I've seen are cuts around the eyes. And then another thing happens that heals rather quickly. Your fighter in... has to take a urine test after a fight, if it's a big fight, if he's going to get paid. In other words, if he's been using drugs, he will not get paid for the fight, and if he wins, he will be disqualified. But sometimes when they urinate, it comes out, the urine comes out the color of port wine.
Because of the blood?
It's pure blood from the kidneys.
Huh. You know the expression punch drunk, where somebody seems to have lost some of their senses, some of their capacity to think and speak because they've been knocked around too much.
Sure.
Do you see boxers who actually have that condition?
Sure. Yes. I work with one right now who talked like that. He talked to a known, and he walked with a limp, and you have to say, what? What did you say? What? Now, why did that happen? That happened because he was a great young fighter who never got into shape. He tells a great story. He says he prayed before every fight. He said, God, please let me get through this fight, and I promise next fight I'll be in shape. And he said, and I never got in shape. So he fought too long. He got hit too much. One of the reasons he's talking that way is because his nose is broken. It goes off at an angle. But indeed, there's an example. And you know what? He has no regrets whatsoever. He'll joke about the whole show.
In your book, you write, boxing is an unnatural act. Everything in boxing is backwards to life. Instead of running from pain, which is the natural thing in life, in boxing, you step to it. You've boxed as well as worked as a cut man. What's it like to try to get over those natural instincts and replace them with boxing instincts?
Well, I boxed, but you have to understand, my boxing began when I was 48, and I sparred in the gym. I worked out in the gym. I did what we call worked. And I didn't do it as long as I would have, but and you also, if you can imagine, I wear glasses, so when I was sparring, I was throwing punches at shadows, so I probably took more shots than I would have. What happens to you is you become focused on the idea of landing your shots to the other guy, of doing damage to your opponent. And so you take shots, and you have to understand that you're in what's called, you know, Hemingway called hot blood. And so the shots don't hurt you as much while you're excited, because adrenaline is part of the formula. It's later on that fighters, you know, for a day or so afterwards, they'll be holding their ribs, or you'll see fighters wearing dark glasses for a couple days, that sort of thing.
I imagine it was a little harder for you to take blows or heal from wounds in your late 40s.
Oh, sure. And I had teeth cracked. I'd had my nose broken before, but I had it broken again. And I would have kept on boxing. I had to quit because I developed a jaw problem, and I was told that I had to wear braces. So you can't box and wear braces. So that's a regret that I have. But nonetheless, a necessary thing for me to have done. Along the way, I found that I was able to do this stuff. I was able to focus. I was able to remember the mechanics. First of all, do the mechanics. The mechanics free your mind. Now, how do you hit this other guy? In a street fight, you can rush up and grab someone by the shirt, by the throat, by the neck, by the head, trip him, knock him down, kick him, and all of that good stuff. But in the ring, it's very hard to hit an opponent who's not going to stand there and fight you back. If he just moves, you're probably not going to be able to do much more than tap him on the shoulder. So, you know, I learned how to do all of this stuff, how to cut off the ring, how to throw punches correctly, how to protect myself, So, you know, it became a way of life for me to the degree that I actually quit writing. I said, why am I ruining my life writing when I can do this other thing? I can participate in it every day instead of being an outsider, instead of being, you know, someone howling in the woods for all those years. And writing became unimportant to me. And I said, forget it. I'm not gonna hurt like that anymore. And so I know about hurt outside of the ring as well as inside of the ring.
You're talking about the hurt of rejection?
Absolutely. That would destroy me. It would just put me flat on my face.
That hurts more than the broken nose?
Oh, absolutely. No comparison. I'd take a broken nose any old day. To sit there, you know, with that brown envelope in your lap and your head in your hands, and you say to yourself, who am I kidding? I'm no good. If I was any good, somebody would have bought this. I'm just kidding myself. I've wasted my life. I've thrown it away. I thought it was the muse who kissed me, who tapped me on the shoulder, and it was a whore that did. And I've been drained of all my resources. Here I am, a complete fool. Why am I doing this? I've just kidded myself. And I'd go through that, and then slowly, I'd get back to my feet. Suddenly, another story would play before my eyes, and I'd be back at it again.
My guest is F.X. Toole. He has a new collection of boxing short stories called Rope Burns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is F.X. Toole, and he's a cut man. That is, he's in the corner of the ring during a boxing match, and it's his job to stop the bleeding of his boxer. He's written his first collection of short stories. It's called Rope Burns, Stories from the Corner. Now, I know as a young man you studied acting with Sanford Meisner, the famous acting teacher at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York.
Yes.
You had written plays that weren't produced, but you wrote them. Any connection between boxing and theater?
Oh, there's a lot of performance in boxing. In fact, when I see fight movies and they try to train fighters to perform like fighters, it usually doesn't work. Oftentimes, they don't take enough time because it takes a long time to learn how to do this stuff. And So I would say that they probably should take fighters and train them to be actors. It would probably shorten the process. But indeed, there's a lot of showbiz in the game, and the audience is there to be entertained. You entertain them differently than, say, in the theater. And yet the drama is there. It's real drama. It's going on right before their eyes. And all sorts of things are being tested and challenged throughout the course of X number of rounds. And the audience, when they see it and see that it's done well, absolutely becomes enchanted with the activity and are transported.
Of course, in boxing, it's not stage blood, it's real blood.
It's the real deal.
And you like that?
Sure.
Why do you prefer real blood to stage blood?
Well, because it's real. You know, I was a bullfighter, and I was gored three times. And so for me to see blood pumping out is not that big a deal. I was gored in the bladder, I was gored in my left leg a couple of times. One of the times there were three trajectories that were as long as your hand. And at the time I weighed probably 140 pounds. I'm 6 foot tall, so you can imagine how thin my leg was. It's part of the territory. It's the price of doing business. It's being there at the time when the greatest challenge is met, and then it's also being there when that challenge is met in a positive or a negative way. And so again, it's real drama. It's not playing. I can go home after the theater or go to the local bar and have a few pops and forget about it. This is stuff that you take for the rest of your life with you for the rest of your life. And that's what I see life as, a series of experiences that should be lived, not nullified, not anesthetized with drugs, etc.
What about street fighting? Were you ever into that? I mean, it's not in an arena, but there's certainly a lot of theatrics and a lot of street fighting and a lot of posturing as well.
Well, I've been in a few street fights. When I was 40, 49 or so, something like that, I was in a street fight and I had part of my right ear bitten off, as a matter of fact. But my opponent was about to go blind, and the only thing that saved him was his girlfriend pulling me off of him. So street fights are nasty and ugly, and the goal is to do maximum damage in the minimum amount of time. So and you get your adversary down, and you want to make sure he cannot get up, and if he does get up, he's never going to want to come looking for you again. In boxing, winner loser, they go across the ring and they embrace and say good fight, and the loser says, well, he was a better man today. If he has talent and ability and one thing and another, that may well be the case. So he'll come back and fight another day. Street fights, you don't ordinarily fight the second or third or fourth or 20th time afterwards.
Who was the first person who read one of your stories and said, "I'm going to publish this"?
It was Howard Junker, God bless him, at a literary magazine out of San Francisco called Zyziva, and Z-Y-Z-Z-Y-V-A. And one day I got a phone call, and he introduced himself, and he said, "This is a terrific story. I want to publish it." And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, no, I want to do it." And we chatted a moment, and I think for the first time in my life, I used the word flabbergasted, because I've never used that word before, because I usually have plenty to say, right? But I just could not. I could not believe it. At that moment, I was vindicated, if you will. At that moment, I was a successful writer.
Had you sent him the story?
I had sent him the story through the mail, like I always have. I never put any blurb about myself. I just submit the story, and I was always very selfish about writing. If I was going to have any success in writing or be published at all, I wanted to be absolutely on the merit of the work, as read by someone anonymous, reading an anonymous writer. And that's what happened finally after 40 years.
You're somebody who, in a way, starts things or accomplishes things late in life. You know, you started boxing at the age of 48. You're about 70 now, is that right?
70, yeah.
Yeah, and your first book has just been published. This is something you've wanted your whole life. What's it like to get something that you've always wanted, but get it at the age of 70 when you're not looking ahead at your whole life any longer?
Well, it's sweet indeed. I will also tell you that if this had happened to me at 35, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, because I was, let's say, something of a wild man. I would probably have destroyed myself along the way, because I'm hoping to make some money on this, but let's assume that I would have made some money. I would have probably squandered it and squandered everything else along with it, because I would have wanted to push the envelope on principle, but also in terms of understanding the world, and if nothing else, to have more things to write about. So it's probably the best thing that could have happened to me individually. I look around and I see so many young people who get success early on, fold in the stretch, if you will, and destroy themselves and destroy a lot of people around them. And what a great tragedy that is, because I think many of them end up with success that they don't feel they've earned. I've earned every bit of it. However much I get, I will have earned it. And I don't say that as some kind of a nut puffing myself up. I'm just saying I paid my dues. Here it is. Thank God it's here. And I'm going to protect it and nurture it to the best of my ability.
Have you saved all your earlier writing? And do you like some of that stuff?
Some of it I do. I will tell you, the first thing I really wrote seriously was a bullfight novel, after I had been blown out of the game and I returned to California, to Los Angeles. And I was working in the Good Humor ice cream factory, the Swing Shift. I was climbing down in the stainless steel vaults with vats with live steam, and go home at midnight, 1 a.m. My wife and baby were asleep. I was still charged up. And somewhere or another, I had the idea that I wanted to write a bullfight novel. So I did. And I still have it. It's wrapped up in the brown paper, you know, in the stamp that I sent it to myself. I think the date is February something in 1958. I'm terrified to open those pages, to go back and read how terrible it must be. On the other hand, there's some great material in there, okay? And if I live long enough, maybe I can go back and use some of that.
Well, FX Tool, Jerry Boyd, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great delight to be with you.
FX Tool is a cut man and writer. His new book is a collection of short stories called Rope Burns, Stories from the Corner. FX Tool is a pen name. The writer's real name is Jerry Boyd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Scholastic, publisher of The Giggler Treatment, a novel for all ages by Roddy Doyle, available at booksellers nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the origins of America's gun culture. We talk with Michael Belleil, whose research refutes several popular conceptions about guns on the frontier. Also, music critic Milo Miles gives us his take on Napster.
Go.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The debate over guns in America often leads back to discussions of early American history and the importance of the gun in frontier culture. But some of the popular beliefs about early gun culture have more to do with myth than history, according to historian Michael Belial. He's the author of the new book Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor at Emory University, where he founded the Center for the Study of Violence. He says that it's a myth that in colonial times most men protected their homes with guns. The guns of the period were muskets, and muskets weren't easy to use.
Basically, to start with, they were big, they were clumsy, they were expensive, they were difficult to maintain, they had to be cleaned regularly because they're made out of iron, otherwise they would rust. It took time to learn how to use one, required a great deal of effort to practice with it, and to maintain the musket was also expensive because powder and shot all had to be imported from Europe, as was the musket itself. No one in America made more than a couple muskets a year. And those few people who did make muskets used, again, European parts. They were actually assembling them.
And you say not only didn't most colonials have guns, there weren't enough guns for the militias.
Yeah, that was for me the most surprising aspect of my research looking back in the 17th and 18th century. The English government wanted to control the access of firearms in the British North American colonies because they, of course, were suspicious of the use of these weapons by common people. They had a problem, though, in their colonies in that they had to rely on those common people occasionally to fight their wars for them. So they would ship arms to the governments of the British North American colonies, and those governments would store the firearms in central repositories to be used only in emergency situations. But again, they were nowhere near sufficient to arm even half the militia in the most vital period of the Seven Years' War.
So tell me, does that shed a different light on the Second Amendment saying that, about the right to a well-armed militia?
Well, it can be read that way. As near as I can tell, the historical context of the Second Amendment had two components. One was the experience of the American Revolution. Those people who wrote and approved the Second Amendment understood, remembered in most cases, that the Americans had been grotesquely underarmed and very unprepared for a long war, which is what they had, of course. It lasted 8 years. And their experience had been that if it had not been for France and the Netherlands supplying 85% of their firearms, with most of the rest coming from the English government itself, there was no way they would have won their independence. So that was one very important context. That's why the Constitution of the United States, before the Second Amendment, gave Congress a mandate to arm, train, and regulate the militia. Now, the second context is that the Anti-Federalists, the opponents of the Constitution, feared that mandate within the Constitution could lead to Congress refusing to arm the militia. And they understood that if Congress didn't arm the militia was largely unarmed because people didn't own that many guns. So Madison, and he was very explicit about this when he introduced the Second Amendment to the House of Representatives, Madison stated that he was responding to those fears, which he thought were ungrounded, of the Anti-Federalists by guaranteeing that no action of Congress would interfere with the state's arming of their own militia. So I believe that's the historical context of the Second Amendment.
And you think that this context has to do in part with the fact that there weren't enough arms to go around?
I think that's exactly right. And the actions of the federal government immediately after the Second Amendment was passed, I believe uphold that view because the Congress immediately took two key steps in opposite directions. On one hand, they wanted to arm the militia, so they established national gun manufactories at Springfield and Harpers Ferry. And the second thing they did is they passed legislation to control the flow of firearms, the sale and possession of firearms, to those they perceived as dangerous, in this context, Indians and slaves.
Now, I think when we're talking about a well-regulated militia, that the word militia in the 1700s and the meaning of the word now has maybe changed. What did militia mean at the time?
The meaning of a militia has changed dramatically. In the 18th century, militia was a very carefully regulated local organization based on the community, whether that was a town or a county, depending on which colony or state we're in. And the membership was specifically defined by each legislature, and it was usually very explicitly limited to white Protestant adult males between certain ages who had demonstrated loyalty to the state. And at different times, loyalty oaths were required for service in the militia. All of this changed dramatically in 1909. The militia had largely died out as an institution in the United States as early as the 1820s. And in the early 20th century, there was an effort to revive the militia on a large scale to prepare Americans for their new global responsibilities. Theodore Roosevelt was a major proponent of this change. And it led to what's called the Dick Act of 1909, which reconstituted the traditional militia as the National Guard. And to this day, of course, the militia of the United States is the National Guard. So it is now very much a national institution rather than a local institution.
So the idea of a well-regulated militia and people having arms for that would be the equivalent now of people having arms who are in the National Guard.
Yes, that's exactly correct. Another, of course, key misunderstanding of the militia, which we can see in some of the private militia companies organized in our own times, is that the militia must always be regulated by the state. That is an ancient understanding that goes back to the 14th century in England and has been maintained in the United States throughout its history.
My guest is Michael Belial. He's the author of the new book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta. You write in your book that until the mid-1800s, the American public seemed kind of uninterested in guns. What did you go through to come to that conclusion? What kind of, like, records and books and other things?
I went through every kind of record I could lay my hands on that had anything to do with firearms or public perceptions of firearms. I looked in legal records, probate records, court records as in civil cases, criminal prosecutions, newspapers, magazines, business records, personal account books, letters, diaries, travel accounts. Supposedly everyone owned firearms, according to the standard histories in my field, and everyone cared deeply about those guns, that they was part of their identification. But in fact, there were no pamphlets or books published on firearms prior to the American Revolution, and until the 1830s, there were only a handful of such pamphlets and guns published. And in addition, the newspapers were surprisingly quiet on firearms until the 1830s.
To me, growing up with Westerns on movies and TV, I always assumed that everyone in the West had a gun and that the gun really helped settle the West. Is that truth or fiction?
I grew up with exactly the same image and from exactly the same source, Western movies. And I think that's, in fact, has been the most influential historical record. Historians who have looked back into the later 19th century, looking at the period we call the Wild West, have found that the majority of settlers did not own firearms, largely because they were not necessary. Most of the settlers in the West were farmers or workers, something we tend to forget. The vast majority of men living in the West were, in fact, workers working in mines and as hired labor on farms, and they had no need for guns.
So from what I get out of your book, the real turning point in the history of the gun in America is in the 1840s when Colt starts to manufacture a pistol.
I think that's exactly correct. Samuel Colt was a genius, not only of technological development, but also of marketing. Samuel Colt appreciated that the gun did carry a certain mystique among the upper class, that it was associated closely with the elite way of life. This is, again, a tradition that goes back to medieval England, that the firearm was something that was owned only by members of the elite. Now, this was no longer the case in America, but nonetheless, it was associated with the upper classes. And so he appealed to this taste in his firearms by making them objects of real aesthetic beauty. He developed a method by which he could engrave every gun he produced with scenes of nature, with scenes of well-to-do people hunting in forests, but perhaps most significantly with scenes of individual men defending their families against savages and against burglars and robbers. So adding to the firearm this perception that it was absolutely necessary for personal self-defense. And his advertisements that he put in newspapers and magazines throughout the United States emphasized again and again that the individual man must own a gun in order to protect his family.
Samuel Colt's patent for his pistol ran out in 1857, so then other gun manufacturers started making pistols too. So now you have a real proliferation of guns in America. And then just a few years later, you have the American Civil War, which you also consider a real turning point in gun culture in the U.S. You say the Civil War armed the American people. Explain what you mean.
Well, most American soldiers went into training in the Civil War on both sides, North and South, with very little familiarity with firearms. Those who were responsible for training the soldiers reported that the majority of their troops had never even held a gun of any kind prior to enlistment. Their first necessary step was therefore to train their soldiers in the use of firearms. This training had an enormous impact in the long term because, after all, more than 2.5 million Americans served during the Civil War. In addition, the gun manufacturers found the Civil War a major opportunity to increase levels of production. Samuel Colt had figured out in the 1850s how to produce tens of thousands of guns for the first time, but he didn't have the market to justify that level of production. So, for instance, in 1860, in the entire United States, 50,000 firearms were made, which was the highest level of gun production up until that point. But by 1864, American gun makers were able to produce 1 million firearms a year. So this level of production, I think, had enormous long-term consequence, as did the training of so many American men in the use of firearms. And I believe also that training men to kill one another and to see that as a justified and necessary action for the preservation of liberty in the United States had an enormous psychological impact on Americans. It meant that the gun was a perfectly legitimate means of conflict resolution.
My guest is historian Michael Belial. His new book is called Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Michael Belial, author of the new book Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, after the Revolutionary War, the government collected all of the guns that were used to arm the militias. What happened to the guns after the Civil War?
The exact opposite. After the American Revolution, the government thought it was wisest to control those firearms that had been given to the United States by the Netherlands and France, or taken from the British on the field of battle. And so they collected them all into armories around the United States. After the Civil War, the government reasoned the exact opposite, that most of these firearms were already outdated because of the development of rapid fire guns, and therefore it was perfectly appropriate and much simpler and cheaper to simply allow troops to take their guns home. And that's exactly what the United States Congress allowed.
And what impact do you think that action had on gun culture?
I think it armed the American public. Guns appeared for the first time in nearly every home, and they became a permanent part of those homes.
There was still a frontier culture after the Civil War. Was that culture a more gun-oriented culture after the war?
Absolutely. Prior to the Civil War, while guns were present in the West, there really were not that many firearms available. And one of the major limitations, of course, was the absence of gun dealers, except for in San Francisco and Los Angeles. After the Civil War, not only was there a steady flow of firearms west as the settlers brought their guns with them from service in the Civil War, but also gun dealers opened shops throughout the Western territories, even in the smallest communities. The smallest towns would find themselves with gun dealers selling very cheap firearms. And that, of course, is one of the remarkable shifts in the gun culture of America. Prior to the Civil War, a gun was the equivalent to a month's wages. It had been the equivalent of half a year's wages for a skilled artisan back in the 18th century. After the Civil War, guns were available for as cheap as $5, which was equal to one day's wages for an unskilled worker.
So when you went back and looked at newspaper magazine articles and probate records and court records after the Civil War, did you see a lot more guns?
Oh, yes. They appeared almost everywhere. Almost everywhere I looked, there were firearms, whereas before there had not been. The probate records, they just skyrocketed. Prior to the Civil War, they appeared in between, depending on the exact region we're talking about, between 10 and 20% of the probate records. After the Civil War, they appeared in the probate record of almost every adult male in the United States in every one of my sample sets. So guns, I think, had become rather omnipresent. But also another reflection of this presence of firearms in American culture is that it was very difficult after the Civil War to read a story, to read even a romance set in the West of the United States without the presence of firearms and of gun violence, something that would have been very unusual prior to the Civil War.
So it sounds like that was reflecting kind of accurately what was happening, that there were a lot more guns, it was a much more violent culture, and the pop culture became more violent too.
I believe that's true, and it's interesting that foreign visitors noticed exactly the same transition. If you read travel accounts written prior to the Civil War, every foreign visitor is looking for what it is about America that's unique. What is it that makes the American democracy different? And they would talk about many factors, mobility and greed being the two most commonly mentioned in travel accounts of the early 19th century. After the Civil War, there is hardly a single travel account that does not mention somewhere how there seems to be guns everywhere, and it becomes associated with a unique American identity, one which is often loathed but often admired, because these are real men. These are men who know how to take care of themselves and know how to defend themselves and their families and who are rough and rugged. That, of course, is the standard that Theodore Roosevelt would appeal to in his very popular books at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th on the winning of the West and the strenuous life.
Now, your history of American gun culture ends more or less after the Civil War. Why did you end it there? Why not keep going? Too much work,
Because it's already such a big book, exactly. And my daughter was getting awfully sick of these stories about firearms. But the larger answer to the question is, I wanted to tell a story about how it was that the most industrialized nation in the world, a nation which had attained a highly civilized democratic culture, one which allowed so much room for dissent and so much room for individual liberty, had developed also one of the most violent cultures in the world, certainly the most violent among the industrialized nations. And for me, that story ends, the story of its origins, if I may say this, ends in the 1870s. That's when that culture is in place, and it's the culture we live with to this day.
How do you think your research is going to be used? You know, gun ownership and gun regulation is one of the most controversial subjects in America. So how do you think your research will be used? How is it being used already? Who's arguing with you?
Well, this is the biggest shock I've had of all. When I wrote this book, I thought that my fellow historians would be interested and my fellow gun aficionados, people who are too easily called gun nuts in the public press, I thought they'd be fascinated by this story. But instead what has happened is I find that those people whom I thought would share my interests in terms of an interest in firearms don't like this book at all. And in fact, I've received a great deal of mail, both regular mail and email, condemning me as anti-gun. And when I've given talks over the last 5 years on the origins of American gun culture, there's always someone who stands up and says, you know, why are you so anti-gun? And I think this is very peculiar, because if I was talking about automobiles, and if I were to say that in the early years of the 20th century there were very few cars in America, no one would get up and call me anti-car. But what is happening is I'm being labeled anti-gun every place I look. And this is, again, a very peculiar categorization of me. As a matter of fact, I've received mail from members of the National Rifle Association, including from their organizational headquarters, attacking me for being so anti-gun. Apparently, by questioning the solidity of this image of the past, of Americans as having always been gun nuts, I'm calling into question the current culture of gun ownership. This was never my intention. My intention was to find exactly when the gun culture started.
Do you think that the gun lobby in America has been drawing upon false history to justify its desire to prevent any further regulation of guns?
If I may restate that, I think they have been drawing upon a mythologized past to justify their position in terms of opposing any gun regulation today. I think that is correct. Now, I'm not going to criticize them for that. I would never do that, because historians have been repeating the same stories for the last 40 or 50 years. It is intriguing that if you go back into the 19th century, you find historians who aren't saying that all Americans own guns, because they knew better. But somehow we have come in the later 20th century, now, of course, entering the 21st, to believe that we have always been like this, that history somehow is immutable. But history is not immutable. So if what is happening, I believe, is that the gun lobby, based only in their initial response to my book, and even before it's been published, in fact, drawing conclusions on the research before they've read it, I think they are trying to prevent a fair and open discussion of the reality of America's gun ownership.
Michael Belial is the author of the new book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor of history at Emory University. Coming up, music critic Marlo Miles on Napster. This is Fresh Air. A major conflict between technology and culture began when a program file called MP3 joined a website called Napster. This enabled anyone with basic computer literacy to download whole songs with good sound and give copies of the songs to anyone who asked. What the Napster people present as a harmless cyberspace equivalent of a record swap, the music industry and some musicians regard as the digital apocalypse. Music critic Marlo Miles guesses that the truth lies somewhere in between.
I'm a music fan of two worlds. I was raised on vinyl, became addicted to it. But I've worked for an online media company for 3 years and feel online music is the face of tomorrow. And the nature of that tomorrow is the hot cultural topic of the moment. Whether or not Napster is central to your music life, the issues it raises concern everyone's information future. One reason there's been a zillion stories about Napster and free music downloads is that it's a conflict made for cynical modern media. All the parties involved, consumers, musicians, record labels, feel disrespected by the others. Likewise, opinions and pompous prognostications outnumber cold facts by, again, about a zillion to one. Remember, consumers, musicians, and record labels have a long history of mistrust. Pirated copies of songs have been an issue since the days of sheet music more than a century ago. Until rock performers began to get smidgens of control over their work in the late 1960s, the music industry treated them like chattel. Record labels have zero credibility with customers. The price of CDs stays high, though it was promised to go lower and lower. Worse, the music industry is the biggest Chicken Little in history. How long can the sky keep falling before it gets here? Bootleg LPs are going to destroy the business. Home taping is killing music, and now MP3 files are ruining the future. Music fans want vengeance. Download a song and stick it to the big label honchos. Angry fans don't want to hear about copyright control from monstrously wealthy artists like Metallica. But consider fiercely independent players like Amy Mann. She recently reestablished her career with help from her own website sales, and she doesn't want to hear how Napster visitors are just sharing rather than illegally copying her songs. Free music downloads and their technology have upped the energy of piracy. Bootleg albums and home taping are theft, but they're cumbersome and often involve material not for sale anywhere else. It's fiendishly easy to copy from Napster and the even slicker music dispensers waiting in the wings. And even though nobody really knows if downloads have hurt retail, we do know that most of them involve best-selling material. Record companies, fans, musicians. It's hard not to conclude that the record industry is the heavy in the dysfunctional three-way relationship. It's been slow and stupid with technology from the start. 8-track tapes, quadraphonic sound, digital audio tape. But the industry can sure pay for lawyers. U.S. District Judge Jed Rakoff just ruled that online music provider MP3.com violated copyright law, and the multi-million dollar fine has thrown a heavy chill over all free download operations. But you can't stop the tide from coming in by slapping it with a court order. Lawsuits are no substitute for adapting to technology. The recording industry simply must get moving. The labels must ditch complacency and give up monopolistic control of distribution. I agree that although the hurdles are huge, subscription services similar to cable television is the most equitable notion anybody has come up with. If we can get to a situation where an online hour of music costs $5, everybody should be happy enough. The no-rules alternative suggests a vision of cyberspace as a boundless dumping ground where everything that can be digitalized is left in a heap for anyone to swipe as often as they like. The old internet watchwords were, information wants to be free. But is that all novels, movies, and songs are anymore? Free information?
Milo Miles is music editor at rock.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharuk. Orji Bentham is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books, publisher of Yoga and the Quest for the True Self by Stephen Cope, now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Writing for the President, we talk with Michael Waldman, President Clinton's former director of speechwriting. He's written a new book called POTUS Speaks. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.